This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
The Sam and Rose Stein Institute for Research on Aging is committed to advancing lifelong health and well-being through research, professional training, patient care, and community service. As a nonprofit organization at the University of California San Diego School of Medicine, our research and educational outreach activities are made possible by the generosity of private donors. It is our vision that successful aging will be an achievable goal for everyone. To learn more, please visit our website at aging.ucsd.edu.
This is really an honor for me to be a part of this important program and to share with you my perspective on intermittent fasting for cardiometabolic disease prevention and to promote healthy aging. I've been fortunate to be involved in research in collaboration with UCSD and the Salk Institute in this area for several years, and I'm always thinking about ways to help my patients prevent cardiovascular disease, to stay healthy, to enjoy a long and healthy life. And I'm excited to share with you this talk tonight on intermittent fasting as one important way that I think we can help our patients and help each other do this. So the theme for tonight is going to be that life on Earth is adapted to the rotation of our planet. And what does that mean? How does that impact what we should be thinking about, what we should be doing in a strategy to live a long, healthy life and avoid cardiovascular and cardiometabolic diseases? And what is lifestyle and how do these things come together? When we're talking about lifestyle in cardiovascular disease prevention, as everybody on this call knows, there are so many things that we consider, that we hear about, that we learn about, that we have to weigh in deciding what to do with our time and how to live a long and healthy life free of cardiovascular disease. And I would argue that lifestyle is what, when, and how much we eat, sleep, and move on a daily basis. And the when is what we're really going to focus on tonight. So the when is very important. When we move, when we eat, when we sleep, and we've changed the way that we do these things over time. Our opportunity to eat, the time we spend sleeping, the time we spend engaged in physical activity has all changed in the modern era. And you can see compared to our ancestral rhythms or day-to-day lifestyle, we have really expanded our opportunities to eat while limiting our physical activity and time spent sleeping. And this nearly around the clock opportunity to eat, I think has a lot to do with the risk of cardiometabolic diseases like obesity, metabolic syndrome, and diabetes that we face today. You can see instead of rising with the sun, eating opportunistically during two or three times during the day, and then transitioning back into sleep and living a healthy, physically active life all day long. Now we spend much less time engaged in physical activity. We eat maybe even before the sun comes up. We eat multiple times throughout the day and into the evening and as the sun sets. So I would argue that this pattern of modern daily rhythms is an important consideration in developing lifestyle strategies to prevent cardiovascular and cardiometabolic diseases. And there's a biological basis to this. You can see on the slide the number of physiologic processes that follow a daily rhythm. And that's what I mean by life on Earth is adapted to day-night cycles and a daily rhythm. Through our modern lifestyle, live this more erratic lifestyle that does not follow a typical circadian rhythm of metabolism or this normal day-night cycle that we're really adapted to. And as you can see, this erratic lifestyle is related to an increased risk for cardiovascular and cardiometabolic diseases, including an increase in the prevalence of risk factors like high blood pressure, as I mentioned, metabolic syndrome, prediabetes, and diabetes. And what we would like to encourage patients to do is to adopt more of a circadian lifestyle, where we're really thinking about the way in which metabolism follows this day-night cycle, and the circadian rhythm of metabolism is something that we're thinking about, not only in terms of when we're up and active, but especially when we are eating. Now, before we get into intermittent fasting and the importance of meal timing and the importance of aligning dietary intake with a circadian rhythm of metabolism, let's take a step back and look at caloric restriction. So one of the things that forms of intermittent fasting have in common is some degree of caloric restriction. It happens unintentionally in some forms of intermittent fasting, like time-restricted eating, which we'll talk about in detail this evening, but intentionally in other forms where caloric intake may be reduced to 25% of a typical day on fasting days. What about continuous caloric restriction? There has been a long interest in the potential health benefits of daily caloric restriction over prolonged periods of time. And many animal studies to suggest that caloric restriction does lead to longer lifespan. And in data like I'm presenting here, may also reduce the risk for chronic diseases. In non-human primates who undergo caloric restriction, represented on the slide as CR, you can see that those animals are living longer free of age-related morbidities. Age-related morbidities like cancer, insulin resistance, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. So the question is, can we translate the longevity, the increase in lifespan, and the potential benefits with regard to avoiding age-related morbidities from caloric restriction in animals to caloric restriction in humans? And yes, there are data suggesting that caloric restriction is beneficial to humans. For example, the calorie study was a landmark trial, a 6-month randomized control trial in overweight individuals, and they were randomized to either a control diet, 25% caloric restriction, a more intense form of caloric restriction plus exercise, or a very low calorie diet. As you can see in the figure here, we're looking specifically at the impact of caloric restriction on weight, and all forms of caloric restriction over 6 months were effective compared to control in promoting weight loss. What about the cardiometabolic or metabolic benefits of calorie restriction? This is just one example of a case control study showing that over 6 years for those undergoing calorie restriction compared to a typical US diet used as the control group here, there were a number of improvements in the biomarkers that we follow for cardiovascular health. And you've all had your lipids measured, your blood pressure measured, your fasting glucose and insulin, and generally speaking, lower is better. So if you look at the CR or calorie restriction group in this study, you'll note the lower LDL cholesterol, the lower triglycerides, the lower systolic blood pressure, diastolic blood pressure, fasting glucose. So I think it's fair to say that there is benefit to caloric restriction. The difficulty in long-term caloric restriction in people is with this long-term need for persistence or adherence to a calorie-restricted diet. It's difficult to do. And most of the time, when we've studied calorie restriction, as you can see in this table, we've combined it with other forms of healthy lifestyle change, like an increase in physical activity. And we know that when you combine calorie restriction with other favorable lifestyle changes, like an increase in physical activity or exercise, individuals experience weight loss and oftentimes other cardiometabolic benefits, including a reduction in fasting glucose, as one example presented here on this slide. But as I just mentioned, the difficulty in using calorie restriction as a lifestyle change over time is with adherence and the risk of weight regain, the risk of cardiometabolic risk factors coming back with a loss of adherence to that calorie restricted or more comprehensive lifestyle strategy that includes calorie restriction plus other things like healthy diet and lifestyle changes. And really, none of these things, when we're talking about calorie restriction, have considered the daily rhythms of metabolism, the circadian rhythm. This is more about drop the amount of calories that you consume on a daily basis and you will benefit. But the issue is in sticking to that over time to see those long-term benefits. So could there be another way of getting at something that typically does involve calorie restriction, intermittent fasting, but is based on principles of that daily circadian rhythm of metabolism? Maybe there's benefits beyond weight loss. Maybe there could be particular metabolic and cardiovascular benefits of a diet or lifestyle strategy that not only involves some caloric restriction, but follows the circadian rhythm of metabolism and those normal day-night cycles of metabolism that I described at the beginning of this talk. And there's been a call for these dietary or lifestyle interventions from the American Heart Association, for example, that look at meal timing and meal frequency. We know that we have to go beyond calorie restriction. We have to go beyond the content of foods. Don't get me wrong, a heart-healthy diet is critical, the content of the foods that we eat. We need to consume a heart-healthy diet style. But I think there's more to it than that. And this scientific statement from the American Heart Association suggested that a more intentional approach to eating that focuses on timing and frequency of meals could be the basis of a healthier lifestyle and improved risk factor management. And here's the key. Because feeding and fasting entrain clock genes, which regulate all aspects of metabolism, meal timing can have serious implications for the development of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and obesity. So perhaps intermittent fasting is an important tool for cardiometabolic health. Perhaps it's something that goes beyond calorie restriction or other strategies that we've used in the past. And what was meant in that American Heart Association statement about clock genes and the importance of the lifestyle strategy aligning with the circadian rhythm and the expression of clock genes? Well, as I mentioned, our physiology is regulated by an internal clock that generates daily rhythms of metabolism known as circadian or around one day. And much of the physiology in our bodies is really adapted to the rotation of our planet with signals that we receive from things like exposure to light, but also exposure to food and other cues in our environment. The central clock in the body is in the brain. It's in the suprachiasmatic nucleus depicted here. And light entrains the central clock, entrains the cells and gene expression in the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And you can see in those images the pictures of the cells in the suprachiasmatic nucleus lighting up as they express genes in response to stimulation by light, by the rising of the sun. The central clock then sends downstream signals to peripheral organs like the liver. And this circadian rhythm of metabolism from brain to liver functions in a predictable way day after day until food comes into the picture. When the bagel is introduced to the liver, gene expression there changes. So there's input not only from the brain down to peripheral organs like the liver that determine the expression of genes involved in metabolism at the liver, but the exposure to food and other cues can reset the clocks and affect gene expression. So it's important for all of these cues to align and to occur in a predictable and rhythmic fashion each day to ensure that metabolism and the expression of these genes occur at the appropriate time to optimize metabolism and the body's ability to metabolize, break down, and process that bagel needs to be received at the right time when the liver is cued and ready to metabolize. So how does this link back to cardiovascular disease or cardiometabolic risk? Well, as a cardiologist, I'm thinking about the risk of plaque buildup within arteries, atherosclerosis, and understand that this is a process really driven by multiple risk factors that are related, that come together to promote the progression of plaque and the risk for cardiovascular events like heart attack and stroke. Increases in hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of blood sugars in the body, LDL cholesterol, like I mentioned, triglycerides, increases in blood pressure, all of these things accelerate the progression of atherosclerosis. These are driven by changes at the organ level, in the pancreas, development of prediabetes related to the onset of insulin resistance in peripheral organs like skeletal muscle, proteinuria, and other forms of kidney disease that occur as a part of a cardio-kidney metabolic syndrome, fatty liver disease, and ultimately atherosclerosis leading to cardiovascular events like heart attack and stroke. And again, the expression of these clock genes in the suprachiasmatic nucleus depicted here as lighting up in response to internal cues, as well as cells that can be entrained by exposure to light. These cells follow this 24-hour cycle of gene expression. And I think in developing a lifestyle strategy that gets at multiple cardiometabolic risk factors all at once, I think getting our metabolism better aligned with those cues coming from these cycles from the central clock down to peripheral organs like the liver really has the potential to play a key role. And we need to bring our metabolism back in line with those cues. If you look at the way that the physiology in the body changes at an organ level through day-night cycles, again, you can see when we're awake and we're eating, there are processes happening in muscle, fat, liver, pancreas, and then all of these things shift. The sun sets, we should switch into more of a sleep and fasting state. But the things that we do in our daily modern life disrupt this: sleep deprivation, prolonged wakefulness, we're staying up late with the lights on, working, we're eating first thing in the morning and late into the night. We neglect our clocks. We don't really think about the fact that our metabolism would otherwise run on a very predictable schedule if it weren't for us doing shift work, traveling, undergoing time zone changes, eating late into the night. And we do see real metabolic consequences of these behaviors. So with all this in mind, let's go from caloric restriction to a lifestyle strategy that aligns with this 24-hour cycle of metabolism. So what I have depicted here is time-restricted eating, so 8 to 12 hours. If you put all of the calorie intake exposure to foods within this 8 to 12-hour window in this normal wake and feeding cycle, you are introducing food and calories to the body, to the organs, when they are optimized to metabolize that dietary intake. When we talk about intermittent fasting, though, we've all heard about intermittent fasting in a general sense, and there are a lot of different ways of doing intermittent fasting, and it's important to understand how these differ and what we're talking about when we discuss intermittent fasting. All of these forms of intermittent fasting have their own potential benefits, their own evidence base, but differ in important ways. So 5-2 intermittent fasting generally involves 2 days of fasting per week, with a reduction to about 25% of typical calories on fasting days, without limitations on dietary intake the rest of the days of the week. Alternate day fasting is usually an every other day fast, with calories restricted to 25% of a typical day on those alternate fasting days. Time-restricted eating does not explicitly ask for a reduction in caloric intake. It's really all about limiting the window of time during the day during which dietary intake occurs, without putting a cap or a count or numbers on the calories consumed within that window. But you do it every day, and it creates a prolonged period of overnight fasting that occurs every single night. And then periodic fasting, which is the least common of those depicted here, would be really dropping calorie intake for consecutive days. We're going to talk about primarily time-restricted eating because I've been fortunate to be involved in this work. And I think it is really the form of intermittent fasting that really best aligns with these circadian rhythms of metabolism that we're talking about. Something that does ultimately and really inadvertently result in caloric restriction, but isn't really based around that principle. It's really based around the principle of trying to get calories and dietary intake into the body during the right time in that 24-hour cycle, within that period where the body is really primed and ready to metabolize food. So this is an example of what we call a feedogram from one of our studies. And what we do is we have participants log everything they eat in a smartphone app. And you can see along the bottom of the figure, the time of day. You can see along the side, the days of the week. And every dot is a dietary intake event that the participant has logged in the smartphone app. So you can see in the beginning, in panel A, one of our participants is eating fairly erratically, early in the morning sometimes, maybe a little bit later on other days, late into the night, sometimes almost all the way to midnight, and creating an average of 14 hours over this monitoring period, during which on a daily basis, on that 14-hour period, that's when calorie intake is occurring. And when we ask participants in our studies to adopt a time-restricted eating window, we use a self-selected eating window where we have participants generally reduce that window of time to something around 8 or 10 hours during the day. And you can see here, this is a typical example where somebody has shifted their first morning calorie to occur later, and they've moved up the last calorie so that it's occurring earlier in the evening. And now, if you look at their average eating window over the course of this monitoring period, it's more like 10 hours. And they've created a prolonged period of overnight fasting that occurs every single day. So I'm sure you've seen some of the news about time-restricted eating, and this has been studied not only for potential weight loss benefits, but really for the potential to promote cardiometabolic health. And one of the things that all forms of intermittent fasting have in common is this idea of potential metabolic switch. So I talked about how in time-restricted eating in particular, we're trying to align dietary intake with the body's normal circadian rhythms of metabolism. But what also happens when you fast? The body switches its fuel source, and importantly, begins to use ketone bodies as a source of energy in multiple organs, as depicted here. And that leads to the use of ketones for ATP or energy production, and also has downstream effects that we think are favorable at a cellular level. Things like an increase in mitochondrial biogenesis, an increase in cellular autophagy, something that's needed to clean up and get rid of dead and dying cells in organs. There are studies to suggest that when we go into some form of safe ketosis, that there are these potential benefits related to that shift in energy source, that metabolic switch to the use of ketone bodies. So we think this happens in, as I mentioned, multiple forms of intermittent fasting. And while more research is needed in this area, it could be one of the things that could explain potential benefits to intermittent fasting that go beyond simple calorie restriction. And for time-restricted eating, another clue that there could be something going on that goes beyond simple calorie restriction is the fact that in animal studies of time-restricted eating, animals experience benefits from time-restricted eating even when we don't limit their calorie intake. In this example of studies from our collaborators at the Salk Institute, mice who were treated in a protocol that involved time-restricted feeding, during which their only access to calories or food was at night during their normal wake time, but they weren't allowed access through the rest of the day. Even when they were exposed to a high-fat diet, that's the FA, which is high-fat diet, allowed to eat all the time, access to food around the clock, versus FT, which is a high-fat diet in a time-restricted setting. You can see pretty dramatic effects just by the time restriction. And the important thing about a study like this in mice is that mice tend to eat a consistent amount of calories whenever they have access to food. So it's not just calorie restriction in the time-restricted mice here. There's something more going on when aligning dietary intake to a shorter window to the normal time during which mice are primed and ready to eat that protected them against weight gain in this study, even when exposed to the same high-fat diet as those mice who had access to those food sources around the clock. So now what we're working toward is to translate these results to humans, to our patients, to study participants in our clinical trials. In early work that we did in time-restricted eating in humans, we wanted to look at the potential for the benefits that I've mentioned that go beyond calorie restriction, that go beyond weight loss. And so we thought we should look at patients or individuals who have risk factors for cardiovascular disease and diabetes, those with cardiometabolic risk factors, specifically something called metabolic syndrome. And metabolic syndrome is that combination of related risk factors for diabetes and heart disease, the high triglycerides, high blood pressure, increased waist circumference, high fasting blood sugar. If you have a combination of these things, you have metabolic syndrome. If you have three or more of those, you have metabolic syndrome. And we know that increases your risk of developing diabetes down the road and developing heart disease. So in this pilot study, we had 19 individuals with metabolic syndrome who importantly had a baseline eating window that was more than 14 hours per day, or at least 14 hours per day, as I showed you on that feedogram. And we asked these individuals undergoing this pilot study in time-restricted eating to reduce that window of time during which they were eating anything to a self-selected 10-hour window. And importantly, this was not breakfast skipping. This was, you know, continue to eat in a way that you normally would, but you need to select a more narrow window of time during which that will occur, a self-selected 10-hour window over a three-month period. And you can see, if you look at the table, the baseline characteristics of this group of 19 individuals: elevated BMI of 33 kilograms per meter squared, elevated blood pressure at baseline. And you can look at in the next column for TRE, first of all, the reduction in their daily eating interval was significant, from a baseline of 15 hours per day to around 10 to 11 hours per day, with reductions in weight, BMI, percent body fat, waist circumference, visceral fat rating, systolic blood pressure, and diastolic blood pressure. we were very excited about these results, that simply by asking these individuals with metabolic syndrome to choose a more narrow window of time and create a longer period of overnight fasting every day for 3 months, we saw not only weight loss, but the signal of multiple cardiometabolic benefits. We really want to figure out what's going on here. And so beyond some of the traditional markers of cardiometabolic health, like lipids, blood pressure, and anthropometric measures like body weight, BMI, and waist circumference, we're using tools like continuous glucose monitoring and wrist-worn actigraphy devices to get a very detailed picture day by day of what's happening when our participants undergo both a baseline monitoring period and then follow up through a time-restricted eating intervention. And as I mentioned, we use a smartphone app developed by our colleagues at the Salk Institute to have participants log or timestamp with photos everything that they eat when they're participating in one of our studies. So this is one example of the combined smartphone log, continuous glucose monitoring, and wrist-worn actigraphy from a participant in one of our trials. And you can follow in real time the way that something like glucose changes after a meal. And you can see after breakfast, there's a little bit of a spike. You can see the glucose really rises after that burger, fries, and a milkshake from In-N-Out. And we can really start to understand what's happening, not just comparing beginning versus end of trial values for things like hemoglobin A1C, but look at the day-to-day variability in things like glucose after a meal, to look at measures of activity and sleep using wrist-worn actigraphy, and put it all together to develop these very detailed pictures of what's happening with metabolism as somebody goes through a period of time-restricted eating. And maybe the greatest benefit to patients will be those who have the greatest dysmetabolism or problems with glucose or other cardiometabolic risk factors at baseline. This is just one example of the continuous glucose monitoring tracing for a participant with metabolic syndrome undergoing 3 months of time-restricted eating. And you can see the drop in their blood glucose during time-restricted eating in purple compared to the baseline glucose levels throughout a typical day. So we saw more dramatic changes like this in glucose through continuous glucose monitoring in those who had the most severe forms of baseline dysglycemia or forms of difficulty regulating glucose, forms of insulin resistance. And that led us to where we are now, both with performing a larger randomized control trial in individuals with metabolic syndrome, including elevated fasting glucose or hemoglobin A1C at baseline, and an ongoing randomized clinical trial that we're doing in individuals with type 2 diabetes. The TIMET trial was a large randomized study with 108 participants with metabolic syndrome completing a 3 month intervention of time restricted eating versus a standard of care nutritional counseling. Now, everybody received the same nutritional counseling, but those randomized to the time restricted eating intervention limited their daily eating window to an 8 to 10 hour window. Again, this was personalized, this was self-selected, and this represented at least a 4 hour reduction in their average daily eating window during the baseline period during which eligibility for the trial was established. And you can see our primary outcomes here were to really dig deep into those signals of improved glucose regulation that we observed in our pilot study. And you can see that at baseline for hemoglobin A1C, both groups were in this pre-diabetes range of A1C at around 5.8 to 5.9. We define pre-diabetes by A1C as 5.7 to 6.4. And if we can move the needle on hemoglobin A1C with any lifestyle intervention, we are moving people further away from progressing from metabolic syndrome into diabetes, and thereby lowering their future risk of cardiovascular disease. So you can see, if you look at the top right-hand corner of the table, this between group change or percent change in hemoglobin A1C, the reduction in A1C of 0.1, that could potentially move somebody from that pre-diabetes category down into a normal range for A1C, or at least start moving them in that direction, rather than seeing these individuals progress from metabolic syndrome into diabetes over time. And this was over 3 months. So we see some of these improvements over a shorter term intervention. We see them in comparison to a control group. And so our hypothesis is that if we were to continue with time-restricted eating over a longer period of time, that maybe these benefits would continue, and we could really make an impact in managing some of these cardiometabolic risk factors in these high-risk patients with metabolic syndrome. Now, you may also be aware of some of the controversy around time-restricted eating and whether it really does work. Does it do any of the things that I've been telling you? Is it better than calorie restriction in any way? Is it better than other forms of lifestyle change for weight loss? I think that as in everything in science, we have to take a very close look at all of the studies, positive and negative, coming out of this space. And I think that one of the takeaways from the TREAT study, which was an 8-hour time-restricted eating intervention, was that these authors did not note any difference in weight loss, fasting insulin, or fasting glucose when comparing individuals who were treated with this 8-hour time-restricted eating intervention versus a control standard 3-meal eating plan. But I want you to take note of the time window of that 8-hour time-restricted eating, as opposed to the self-selected windows that we've been studying. These participants were told to eat within a late TRE window at 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. So not exactly aligned with the body's typical daily circadian rhythms of metabolism. And a lot of the study was provided as a remote intervention. And I think that may have also limited some of the follow-up data that the investigators were able to obtain. That said, I think this is an important study and one in which we need to think about the details and the way in which the participants and their baseline characteristics are important, and the way in which we're recommending time-restricted eating and also monitoring adherence to time-restricted eating is important in the clinical trials that we do. There was a large study published in the New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago, also in time-restricted eating, and also a negative result suggesting that when individuals were randomized to an 8-hour time-restricted eating window plus intentional caloric restriction versus caloric restriction alone, there was not any more weight loss occurring in the individuals who had time-restricted eating on top of caloric restriction. I think one of the most important takeaways from this study was that these were really generally pretty healthy people participating in this study. As you can see by the arrows in the table, a relatively young group of participants around an age of 30. And other than obesity, they did not have many cardiometabolic risk factors at baseline. Importantly, if you look at the arrow at the bottom of the table, they also had pretty narrow daily eating windows at baseline. So to go from a 10-hour window to an 8-hour window may not be sufficient to see improvement in things like weight when comparing a time-restricted intervention plus caloric restriction to caloric restriction alone. So what if we go back to looking at those individuals with more of those cardiometabolic risk factors at baseline? I mentioned our group and our studies in those with metabolic syndrome, but similar work has been done in those with type 2 diabetes. This was a randomized control trial in Thailand involving individuals all with type 2 diabetes, baseline mean hemoglobin A1C in the 7-8 range, randomized to two forms of time-restricted eating, 16-8, 14-10, versus control. And you can see these significant improvements in body weight from baseline, A1C, and LDL cholesterol when comparing the intermittent fasting groups to the control group. And if you put multiple studies together in this space, looking at intermittent fasting for those with type 2 diabetes, including time-restricted eating, along with other forms of fasting that I mentioned, alternate day fasting, the 5-2 style of intermittent fasting, there are consistent patterns that we see in individuals with pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes: reduction in body weight, reduction in BMI, lower hemoglobin A1C, fasting glucose, total cholesterol, and triglycerides. So still, some heterogeneity. If you put all these studies into a meta-analysis, you don't see a significant decrease in fat mass, insulin, LDL cholesterol, HDL, or blood pressure. But I think that one of the important takeaways in what we've seen through clinical trials in time-restricted eating and other forms of intermittent fasting to date is that perhaps those with the greatest cardiometabolic risk at baseline are those who stand to benefit most when we're looking for things that go beyond calorie restriction and weight loss, when we're looking for improvement in those cardiometabolic risk factors. So our group is looking to understand this even better through recently completed and ongoing clinical trials in individuals with obesity. I mentioned we have an ongoing study, a large randomized control trial of time-restricted eating in individuals with type 2 diabetes. And we recently started a time-restricted eating trial in hospital shift workers. I mentioned how much shift work, jet lag, travel, all of those things that we do to disrupt our circadian rhythm can affect our metabolism and downstream risk for cardiovascular disease. So we want to see whether time-restricted eating could lead to health benefits in nurses and nursing assistants at UC San Diego. What about adopting time-restricted eating now? Do we have enough data to suggest that this is something that you could start doing on your own? Well, I think that we do have good safety data for one thing. We see adverse events or side effects infrequently with time-restricted eating. There is often a transition period, though, where patients or study participants may experience some hunger, but we find that individuals often adapt fairly quickly to the new eating style and timing of dietary intake. But this is an important point that we do need these ongoing clinical trials to better understand tolerability and adherence, especially over the longer term. As I described, our work has been in 3 months of time-restricted eating. If we want these to be longer-term, even lifetime interventions for our patients, we need to know how they work over a longer follow-up period. And we also need to really understand the potential changes that happen in body composition, not just weight, but what's the difference between loss of fat mass weight, loss of lean mass weight, and we need to be looking for any potential signals there in the trials that we have ongoing. We want to promote healthier body composition, loss of fat mass with preservation of lean mass. That's a priority of all the strategies that we use in weight loss as a part of cardiometabolic disease prevention. But if you wanted to adopt this now, you know, it's a pretty practical intervention. It's something that you don't need a prescription for. If you stop snacking after dinner or avoid dessert or any calorie after dinner drinks, you'll immediately start to create that shorter daily eating window for yourself. Strategy that I use is brush your teeth right after dinner, so you will be less interested in eating something and you'll be forced to brush your teeth again later. So just start that transition into the resting, sleeping mode sometime sooner after you finish that last calorie of the day. And if you can, try to delay the first morning calorie. Consider black tea or coffee. We don't really know the impact of caffeine, but we think it may be less than exposing the body to a calorie first thing in the morning. So if you can do that, if you can push your breakfast back a little bit, and again, we're not recommending breakfast skipping, but if you can delay that first morning calorie, you could in that way also start to create this more narrow eating window or prolonged period of overnight fasting for yourself. So in conclusion, what we know is that calorie restriction and all forms of intermittent fasting, including time-restricted eating, promote weight loss. There is evidence to suggest that calorie restriction and forms of intermittent fasting have potential health benefits beyond weight loss, including the improvement in cardiometabolic risk factors. But there could be something unique about time-restricted eating as a form of intermittent fasting that's grounded in the circadian rhythm of metabolism. We have observed that time-restricted eating has the potential to promote cardiometabolic health, especially in those with baseline cardiometabolic risk factors like the metabolic syndrome. And the promise of time-restricted eating as a part of our lifestyle strategy to promote health and a life free of chronic diseases like cardiovascular diseases is that it's cost-effective, it's free. If it works, if it can do these things to promote health, it's something that could be easily adopted by many people. With that, I want to thank you for your attention. Thank you for your interest in the work that I'm doing with my colleagues at UCSD and the Salk Institute. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, and I'm happy to take some questions.
Great. Thank you so much for that fantastic talk, Dr. Wilkinson. We have some questions coming in. Okay, so I'm going to start with the first question, Dr. Wilkinson. Are there any situations where caloric restriction or intermittent fasting would be discouraged due to, say, chronic conditions or illnesses?
Yes, that's an important point. I think that anytime you're considering adopting an intermittent fasting strategy, it's important to discuss it with your doctor. It may not be a good fit for individuals with certain medical conditions, eating disorders, for example, history of bariatric surgery, and even in individuals with diabetes, I think it's important to discuss it with your doctor, especially if you're using therapies as part of your treatment for diabetes that could increase your risk for hypoglycemia. So yes, definitely something to run by your doctor if you're considering a time-restricted eating or other form of intermittent fasting strategy for yourself.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, here's a question that you answered at the end, but I think that this is one that might get tricky for people. During the intermittent fasting, would beverages like water and herbal tea also be omitted?
No, those would be okay. The key is it's the calorie that triggers the response by the body. That's what really fires up metabolism. So if you replace what you might otherwise have, instead of an after dinner drink or snack or dessert, have a cup of herbal tea, that would start your fasting right there.
Okay. And then you also said for us coffee drinkers, I was thrilled to see that I could have coffee, but you're saying no calories, which means you have to do coffee without like sugars, creamers, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah,
just straight black coffee.
That's what we think. Yes, that's at least what we ask of those participating in our clinical trials. So we think that, again, it's the calorie that would come from the cream or sugar in your coffee that would kick off your metabolism. We don't have enough studies to know really what caffeine, if anything, does in starting out your metabolism for the day. But for now, I think the safest bet is if you've got to have your coffee or tea in the morning, if you can have it black, that's a way to avoid that calorie that would otherwise kick off your metabolism.
Okay, that's a helpful clarification. Okay, thank you. Okay, on one of your slides, it noted 12-hour fasting period. Are there good data on 12-hour versus 10-hour time-restricted periods?
Yes, that's a great question because there have been a lot of studies looking at different eating windows. I think the takeaway there is that we see similar effects for 8-hour windows to 10-hour windows. If you start getting into even more restricted eating windows beyond 8 hours, there aren't as many studies for one thing, but we don't see any clear incremental benefits to doing that. We think the sweet spot really probably is something like an 8 or 10 hour eating window during the day, or a 16 or 14 hour fasting period every night. That's the other way to think about it, both for the benefits, but also for the likelihood of being able to stick with it. If you're doing a more restrictive form of intermittent fasting every day, we think that that would be harder to stick with or adhere to over time.
Okay, got it. So here's a question that actually follows up on that. It comes from one of your slides that you showed towards the end. The one where you talk about time-restricted eating, the 16-8, from 12 to 8, didn't have much weight loss. What time range would be most effective? It might've been on that slide, but I think it got missed.
Yeah, the 12 to 8 window was what they used in the TREAT clinical trial. That was their hypothesis going in, was that maybe that would be a good window. My concern, like I mentioned there, is that, you know, we know that the body's metabolism is starting earlier than that, and that by 8 p.m., you should probably be transitioning more into sleep. You know, the end of your eating window should be earlier than that. In our trials, we ask participants to stop eating at least 2 hours before they go to bed. Other than that, we let participants choose their own eating window so that it's, again, something that they can incorporate into their daily routine. So I think the key, if you're choosing your own eating window, is not to skip breakfast, just to delay it, and to make sure that your last calorie is at least 2 hours before you go to sleep.
Okay. All right. So another person's asking about a 14-hour fast. Do they get good results?
14 hours. So 14 hours every night?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that would be, you know, the 10-hour eating window during the day with 14 hours fasting overnight. That's what we used in the pilot study I mentioned of metabolic syndrome. We were a little more flexible in the randomized control trial of metabolic syndrome, where it was somewhere between 14 and 16 hours of fasting every night. But yes, I think that's the sweet spot.
Okay. And here's a question that I think many people are going to be asking as they're considering doing this. How long does it take for the body to get used to intermittent fasting? This person tried it and got dizzy and anxious.
Yeah, that's a great question. It comes up a lot in our trial work and also in discussing this with my patients. What we see anecdotally is that everybody experiences this a little bit differently. It's much easier for some people than others, and we don't really know how to predict how somebody's going to feel if they try intermittent fasting. But what I will say is that we often have success with people who make it through those first 2, 3, 4 days, maybe even a week, where you feel a little off and it takes your body some time to adjust to that new pattern. There's a lot of anticipation. The body learns when to expect calories. And when you shift that, it does take some transition time. But I would say if you attempt it and even after, you know, 3, 4 days, you're still not feeling well, you should discontinue it, or you should discuss it with your doctor.
Okay. What about cognition? So what are your thoughts on people with, say, mild cognitive impairment in intermittent fasting? Are there benefits to cognitive health that you can speak of?
Great question. And I don't know that we know the answer to that. I think that's one of the areas where we need more studies. And I think importantly, like I mentioned, we need longer term studies. So we need support for longer term studies so that we can get at the potential longer term benefits and more of the potential benefits of intermittent fasting on multiple aspects of healthy aging.
Okay, great. Well, with that, we are right at time. And I'm sorry we didn't get to all your questions. Dr. Wilkinson, thank you so much for your time and your effort and your thoughtful work. It's so meaningful and impactful, and I really appreciate your talk today. With that, I want to thank everybody for joining us. It was so great to have you all here with us. I want to remind you that all of our newsletters, lectures, and any updates on our ongoing research and training programs are available at our website at aging.ucsd.edu. If you want to consider donating in support of our work, you can also do that there. So with that, thank you all for being here with us, and we'll see you back in July.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.